VorpalNetwork.com.
This episode of The Tome Show is brought to you by NobleKnight.com, where Out of Print is available again. And listeners like you, thanks for using the Tome's Amazon store.
This is Ethan.
Jeremy.
And this is Nathan.
From the Gamers Haven podcast, and you're listening to
The Tome.
In ancient times, that book was said to unlock the gates to another dimension, to another race of beings.
Welcome to The Tome, episode 130. The Tome is a D&D news, reviews, and interview show, and I'm your Tome host, Jeff Greiner. In this episode, a nature-loving drowess is going to tell me how to pick out monsters in this evil advice episode with Andrew Wilson. Andrew, welcome to the show, sir.
Thanks, Jeff.
So we're going to get into talking about building a drow druid in a little bit. And then we're also going to talk about how to pick out monsters for your game. But I do have a longer than usual bit of news today. There's just tons and tons of news coming out in the last, week or two since I've recorded. Just that there's a lot of things getting to a point where I'm ready to start mentioning things on the show a little bit more. So it may take a little bit longer than most. If this is your first time listening, first of all, welcome. And second of all, just know that normally this news section, not so long. First thing that I wanted to say is that I want to remind people that the Vorpal Network forums are up and running after being in limbo for about a year now. So I'm looking forward to building up some conversations there and getting back in touch with the audience. That's part of what I really loved about the forums is it's a chance to talk to the audience more than, you know, the random conventions that I managed to make it to or those fantastic people I met at Origins a couple of years ago and, you know, that kind of thing. It fills that void on a day-to-day basis, and I can sort of touch base with people. And we talk about D&D and comics and movies and whatever else is going on in the world of geekdom. And I believe you've
and
posted.
And you and I have both posted. Yeah, we both posted some monsters up there. So
that's right.
If anyone's looking for some more monsters, Jeff started a thread and I posted some of mine in there too.
So yeah, we started a thread where we're talking about monsters that we've created on our own sort of thing and talk a little bit about that. So, and there's many other threads as well, but hopefully we can hear some people or see some people over there at the forums. In other podcast news, I am working on a show for next month, and I wanted to put a shout-out or a call-out to you guys to see what I got back. Basically, I'm thinking that next month I want to do an episode reviewing other D&D podcasts, letting the listening audience here know what else is out there in terms of D&D podcasts. And I've contacted a bunch of them out there, and I've gotten some audio clips back from them to include in the show. But I just wanted to say, if you know of anything out there, there's no way I know of every D&D-related podcast in existence. Let me know if there's a show you think I should send an invitation to. Or if you do a D&D podcast, let me know, and I'll get you the information that I need in order to include you and all that. You can always swing by the forums and let me know about a show, or you can email me at thetomeshow@gmail.com. And another area where I'm going to need a little bit of help from listeners is I've mentioned in a few past episodes that I'm kind of working on a special tome secret project that I'm hoping to announce in more detail comes late spring or early summer. But one of the things I'm going to need for that project is I'm looking for people with connections to artists who might be willing to, for the time being anyway, help out with some artwork, you know, for the experience and exposure of doing so, more than, you know, for any actual monetary gain. So if you know anybody that might be interested, or if you are somebody who might be interested, send me an email again at thetomeshow@gmail.com. All right. And I'm down to the last bit here. Next up, you're going to notice in this episode that we are starting a new little mini segment from Mike Shea at Sly Flourish. In every month's advice episode, he's going to give me a short little segment of Sly Flourish advice to include a sort of a little segment to break up the advice topics. Because usually we'll go from one advice topic right into the next. This will be just sort of a few minutes in between to help break up the experience for the listeners and also give another angle of advice from Sly Flourish, and they always do a great job over there. And then in More personal news, I guess. I have mentioned in the past that I'm starting to do some writing over at the At Will blog. And my first article has been published as of today, or at least the day of this recording, where I give some advice on embracing archetypes in order to make a character with more character. So I will have a link in the show notes, and I hope you guys head over there and check out the article and leave a comment. Beyond that, in the world of D&D, there's not really a lot of news since the last recording. The PH3 came out as expected. D&D Encounters is in its, second week now and seems to be going fairly strong. But I just recorded a couple weeks ago, so not much extra new into that bit. Breaking news. This just in, since the original recording of this episode, as I'm editing it, I can now also announce to you that the Vorpal Network has grown by one member. Icosahedrophilia, the 4th edition D&D actual play podcast, but it's so much more than just actual play, has joined the Vorpal Network. You can see their work over at vorpalnetwork.com or at d20.hardworld.com. They've got actual play of an actual 4th edition campaign. But it also includes reviews of products and things they use in their game, sneak peeks at different things here and there. It's a great story and great advice and good source for inspiration. I encourage everybody to check it out, d20.herdworld.com. Find out more at vorpalnetwork.com. So we're going to go ahead and jump on into the next segment, which is what we're all here for. Mr. Wilson from Silent Seven Games is our guest host in this episode. Let's find out what Silent Seven Games is and what you're doing over there.
Well, it's a D&D 4E third-party publisher. It's basically, I guess I want to say, a one-man show. You can go to silent7.com. It's with the word silent, the number 7, and the word 7.com, and take a look at the products. Basically put out fourth edition material. That's maybe kind of my goal, is to kind of do stuff that's a little weirder, a little further out there than what you might expect from, the Wizards of the Coast products. And I have a 7 scale in our About Us section that kind of rates how weird is this? Is it on a complexity versus novelty, axis? Most recent product is called Huckstrapy, about basically use the idea that started is using a deck of playing cards at the table for damage dice. Mm-hmm. So that's the most recent product. So if that sounds intriguing, you can read more about it at the website. You've got other stuff like Aberrant Blood Sorcerer and another product is actually this is the newest, is the Rugged Adventures, where it's an alternate rest system if you don't want to give out encounters every day in your campaign. You can use this rest system and it allows you to do them more slowly over time. It's kind of as the fact that it's a one-man show, it's kind of just whenever I have free time and inspiration kind of deal. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't have a hefty product release schedule, but it's fun for me, and I do the art and the design and the writing pretty much myself. So
cool. So how is it that you ended up making the decision to start the company up?
Well, I mean, everyone has a creative streak, especially if you're playing a role-playing game. So I've always had that. I kind of started thinking, you know, I like making my own stuff. And toward the end of 3.5 days is actually kind of when I started getting more into D&D, and I designed some of my own stuff. I made a class based on the Flamekin from Magic the Gathering Lorwyn block, and it was fine. And then they announced 4th edition right around that time, and I was like, wow, this is really good timing, because there's going to be a new GSL. Obviously, that came with some hoops and excitement of its own, but it did happen. And I kind of felt like it was a new beginning for me to say, okay, you know, tons of people know way more about 3.5 than I do, and I've been playing it for a little while, but this new edition really gives me a chance to get on board from the beginning and write my stuff. So
is there,
that's pretty much... Go ahead.
Is there any overlap between your day job and what you do here that gives you some extra insight as to how to put this all together and be successful at it?
It's not related to my day job right now, but I do have a minor in digital media and a bachelor's degree in English creative writing. And I used to be a web designer, so I made the Silent 7 Games website. So I have a variety of experience, education, and interests that kind of fuel it. But no, my current job is delivering pizza. So,
yeah, I did that for a summer once. It was not my favorite job ever.
It's not my favorite job ever, but it's actually pretty good. So
yeah, I commend you if you're able to do it and do it well. And I imagine it leaves you the time necessary that if you want to pursue some of these extra things, then you can do so.
Absolutely, yeah. I'm not having to work like overtime or something, really. I mean, for a long time, just out of college, I was like, well, I'm just going to work for 20 hours a week, and I can survive on that delivering pizza. So, yeah, it's plenty of free time. I work more now, but there's still a lot of free time involved.
Well, good, and it allows you to release these products. I know we looked at Huckstrapy in a sponsorship spot a while back, and I found the concept very interesting. The idea of it, I sort of in my head, Huckstrapy is sort of the Gambit character from X-Men converted into D&D.
Yeah, and if you look through it, there are actually some somewhat blatant and somewhat hidden references to Gambit.
Sure. So, and these are all published as PDFs, correct?
Yeah, through RPG Now or drivethroughrpg.com. Mm-hmm.
And do you have a hope to someday start seeing them in physical print?
Well, a lot of them are actually shorter, so it's a little tough to fill up a book. Mm-hmm. One of the first products was the Lunar Scrolls, and it's actually about I think 30 pages, and I actually did get a copy printed from Lulu for just for my kind of my own enjoyment. Uh-huh. But it was actually pretty expensive.
Sure.
And I wouldn't expect anyone to pay $20 for a 30 page book, but it's great to look at and great to show people and say, look, I run my own D&D thing. This is what I made. And people are like, oh wow, you made that kind of thing. So
awesome.
So it gets satisfying and to have a full color, but it's not something I expect anytime soon to be on your bookshelf at your local game store.
Sure, sure. Well, good. I know that I'll be keeping an eye out for things coming from Silent 7 and from you as well, so feel free to let me know anytime there's something I should be paying attention to.
All right, will do.
Okay, well, we're going to take a quick break before we start building our Drow Druid and deciding what monsters to put into an encounter so that we can talk about our sponsor for the episode, NobleKnight.com. Noble Knight is a game store in both the real world and on the internet that specializes in buying and selling out-of-print and used game products, be they minis, books, board games, or cards. And my pick for this episode is their product buying service. I've looked at different products they're selling here and there, but this time I wanted to highlight the fact that they do buy your old books. If you're like me and you haven't gotten rid of a single book willingly since about the 1980s or longer, but there's really only a handful of them that you ever actually use, why not consider turning some of those old games into cash or into new games? Noble Knight has a service where you can send them your old products, get compensated for it, and help someone else find the missing book that they desperately needed for their game or their collection but couldn't find because it's been out of print since 1993. You can sell them for cash, or you can get a bonus for trading it in for store credit. And so long as you follow their guidelines, you never have to pay shipping. I urge you all to check out NobleKnight.com and let them know that the Tome Show sent you.
Noble Knight Games has been serving the needs of thousands of gamers worldwide since 1997. With a huge selection of over 30,000 unique products, including discounts on most in-print games of up to 50% off or more. Noble Knight Games is the place for out-of-print RPGs, board games, war games, collectible card games, miniatures, and all things game-related. They ship worldwide and will purchase or trade your titles you no longer need, new, or used. Your satisfaction is guaranteed. Just visit www.nobleknight.com or visit our website for direct access to thousands of new, out-of-print, and in some cases, one-of-a-kind items.
All right, enough of the chit-chat news and sponsors. It's time to get down to what we're really here for. We're going to make ourselves a drow priestess of Loth. You originally pitched this idea to me in the email as we prepared for this as a build that you were considering, and I was a little bit taken aback or confused at first because you said you wanted to make a drow priestess of Loth, and you said it would be a druid or a druid warlock. And I was thinking, when I think priestess of Loth, I usually don't instantly think druid. The warlock, I could kind of see. But as I started building it and as I started looking at it, I started realizing, you know what? While the cleric or maybe even Avenger or even warlock or whatever might be an obvious choice, the druid works really well as a priestess of Loth. So let's go ahead and look through our builds and see what we came up with and why every priestess of Loth should maybe be a druid. First of all, the race, being a drow. What does being a drow provide you that's going to be useful for a druid?
Well, black skin is an obvious one right there. Maybe not druid related especially, but very drow-like to have the black skin. Mm. Well, I mean, you've got your I would kind of pick the drow more for flavor, you know, to kind of start with the priestess of Loth idea, and you know, from there you've got a drow and you know a druid. But you do get some good things. I mean, the dark fire is good for anyone, sure. Right? And you get a bonus to your dexterity, so that can be beneficial for the predator druid, and a bonus to charisma, which is part of why you know the warlock multi-class kind of felt like it might fit in.
Sure. And I found some other ways to look at the statistics and make them work a little bit too. And I find that if nothing else, a druid is a controller, and the racial abilities that drow get can be very controllery as well.
Yeah, that's true. I guess I was paying more attention to just the idea and sure. didn't even really care what the druid did, or I mean, what the drow did.
Well, and that's interesting because usually I'm the person who is really bad at thinking about mechanics, and I'm always all about story. So this is going to probably be a very story heavy focused on this build. What kind of primal aspect did you go with then?
The predator. Okay. I wasn't looking at a big constitution score, and I really, one of my main things for this idea was the idea that she's turning into a big spider a lot. Uh-huh. So yeah, I wanted to do the predator. The plus one to speed is good. It may not be necessary, but it's better than the constitution option, which really is not relevant to my particular character who has a 10 there.
Sure. See, now this is where we're going to split our builds from the very beginning.
Okay.
Because I went with the primal swarm, thinking turn into a swarm of spiders.
Yeah, I looked at that too, and I thought I did pick up some primal swarm-related abilities, but like I said, constitution just wasn't my focus. I'm already putting a big number in the wisdom, which doesn't get a bonus from being a drow, mm-hmm. So I didn't want to have to try to pump up the constitution as well.
Yeah, see, I had to make some pretty hefty concessions in my stats there, didn't I?
Right.
Because
yeah.
My main things that I need to focus on are wisdom and constitution, and my drow doesn't get a bonus in either one of them. But I really like, in my head, I really like the concept of this priestess who, you know, scatters into a swarm of spiders as my druid. So you went with one giant spider. I went with a thousand little spiders, and I think there's a lot of potential there for both of them.
Yeah, it's kind of an idea I've actually had for a while, and I even built the character as an NPC in a Magic the Gathering themed campaign I was running, and this character was from the Golgari elf tribe from mm-hmm. Ravnica, if anyone's familiar with that. But so I had this drow who or a, you know, a dark elf or a Golgari elf who turned into a big spider. And then Primal Power came out, and I was like, oh, look at this swarm build. And I kind of poked through it, but I didn't really feel like it was perfect for the idea I'd already had. And when I was building this character for today, I did think, you know, well, some of these are just too Loth, you know, related to pass up here. So I did pick up some swarm powers, and definitely I can see the druid now turning into swarms sometimes. But if I were playing the character, it'd be a big spider most of the time.
Sure. So what kind of skills did you go with? What were the natural choices? I mean, we get nature for free.
Get nature for free. I picked a background which related to the Drow Outcast. So, you know, she's a priestess of Loth, but for whatever reason, I couldn't really pin down. She left that. Didn't come up with a great story there, but she's a Drow Outcast. So she got added Dungeoneering to her class skill list. So I picked Dungeoneering. Perception, which I think is good for someone with dark vision to have. They can already see better than anyone else, and now they'll be able to have perception to even further be able to see into that distant chasm. Uh-huh. And then Arcana. That was kind of a close call, but I thought Priestess of Loth, maybe Arcana is a better fit than Heal, for example.
And see, I didn't have the Dungeoneering, and so I ended up going Perception and Insight with the idea of it's a drow. She lives in a society where she's getting backstabbed all the time. The more she can look out for herself and read people, the better her survival chances are going to be.
Yeah, I like that Insight choice. Yeah. And so I build a lot of characters with Insight, mm-hmm. and so I just felt like going a little different direction.
Sure. And then I like you, I went with Arcana for my third choice as well.
Okay.
So let's look at feat choices then. We get Ritual Caster automatically as a druid.
Right.
And what did you go with then for your first level feat to start off with anyway?
Well, I actually only build a first level character, so that's my first level feat is... I wrote down a list of feats as alternates, but I ended up going with Pact Initiate, multi-class warlock, right out from level 1.
Okay.
And that will add bluff to the trained skills, which was something I wanted for the drow. And then an at-will power as an encounter from the warlock list.
Yeah.
The natural choice is going to be the Dark Pact, and I did choose that. I really don't like that power, though. The only power I really like from the warlock at-wills is the eye bite. Mm. But I felt like I really want to go with Dark Pact.
For the theme.
Just because. Yeah, right.
Yeah, and see, because of our split in builds with the, you know, with your predator build, and you can have a decently high charisma and everything, you can build a decent warlock. With my build, my stats wouldn't even allow me to pick warlock if I wanted to for the multi-class feat. What I went with was my first level feat of spider swiftness.
Yeah, that's the first one on my list, actually, of my alternate options here.
Which gives you a bonus to speed of plus one or a plus two when you're affected by polymorph or rage powers. And since one of the big things our druid is going to be doing is turning into animals, in our case a spider, they're going to be benefiting from that plus two to speed on a fairly regular basis.
Yes, that's true. My character already has the plus one to speed.
Yeah.
Right, so from the predator, so
you're gonna really.
It's just a little bit too fast, yeah. So I didn't pick that one. The name is an obvious kind of clue that maybe this is what she wants, but I didn't pick it. So
sure.
It's a good one. I mean, I really like the idea of feats that benefit a druid based on their form or based on the concept of what form they might be in. But I was really hoping for something more than speed from a spider related feat. So I have it on my list. I was a little disappointed though, but yeah, actually if I were not using the character builder, I probably still would have chosen Pact Initiate, to be honest. But, in one of the Silent Seven products I made, I have, it's advanced class druid favored forms, which includes a bunch of feats for druids who are in different forms. And there's a scuttling creeper feat, which as long as you are in druid, or as long as you're in wild shape form as a spider, a successful athletics check allows you to climb at normal speed rather than half speed. And once per encounter, when you hit with a melee attack, you can force that target to succeed on an immediate saving throw, or it takes ongoing 5 poison damage save ends.
So it lets you do some wall crawling and makes you a little more spider-like.
Right, and I really was hoping for more kind of poison things, or things that I could theme as being poison. You know, I'm in spider form. I want to bite. So that's from this book what I would pick. But for a kind of to accentuate the spider form transformation.
Sure.
And some of my other feats are focused on that I have on this list, like the Druid of Darkness, which requires that you are a drow. And it says while you're in beast form, you gain a +2 bonus to damage rolls against enemies, granting combat advantage to you. And even if you don't type that as poison, you could concept it as poison.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a little disappointing, though, because I kind of went back and forth, and there's another feat called Ferocious Tiger Form, which is exactly the same feat. It has a different name, but it does the exact same thing, except that it doesn't require that you be a drow, which sure. was disappointing that they would make two feats so similar.
Yeah. I've noticed that a few times,
though. It has to be identical.
Where something will come out, you know, maybe on DDI, and then something different will come out in a book, and they're very, very similar with just really small changes, you know, in the prerequisites, or, you know, one thing doesn't seem quite as cool because it doesn't do as much stuff or whatever. I've seen that several times.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I guess I haven't noticed them as much, but that's pretty bad. I actually went back and forth on the compendium, like click this one, click this one, click this one, click that, watching the text to see if any letter changed.
Uh-huh.
And it just didn't. It is the exact same benefit.
Sure.
But anyway, yeah. And there's some other feats. I have about 4 more feats on here. The poisoner multi-class feat. That was an option over the,
I considered that. Yeah.
Yeah. But it kind of looked like more, I was really going for the spider form to poison, not the humanoid form to poison my weapon,
right?
Kind of thing. So,
I mean, it makes sense for a drow to be versed in the use of poison and what have you. Now, see, I built both a first level version and an 11th level version, so I can look at what I actually took from my 11th level. I took things like Druid of Darkness, which gives you a bonus to damage when you've got combat advantage. Which,
yeah, that's the one I was just talking about.
Yeah, yeah. And so, you know, you've got some things going on there where a lot of the powers you're using, both as a drow and as a druid, give you the opportunity to pull off combat advantage on a fairly regular basis.
Yeah, even one of the at-wills, right?
The swarming locust at-will makes your enemies grant combat advantage when they're in a zone. And then,
yeah, okay.
So I mean, it's there's a lot of synergy there. I also took things like Stinging Swarm. When you're in beast form, enemies that damage you grant combat advantage to you. So it's just another opportunity to get combat advantage, which is then going to pull in that bonus to damage.
For your +2, that's a good combo.
Yeah. And then I also took, you know, more thematically than for anything, I took Loth's Meat, which says if you drop an enemy to 0 hit points, you gain a +1 bonus to attack rolls for a turn.
Yeah, I saw that one. It looked good. It really reminded me of a Warlock Pact Boon.
Uh-huh.
And I thought for a Warlock multi-class, it would kind of draw on the you just pretend it's a Pact Boon. But
yeah. And then
one of the ones on my list is Slithering Form, which says you don't provoke opportunity attacks while crawling in beast form, and you gain a +2 to acrobatics.
Hmm.
And that was kind of another, I'm a spider, I can crawl and not provoke from you.
Yeah, yeah.
I thought that was neat.
Yeah, and it's, there's a lot, it turns out there's a lot of feats and powers, as we're going to get into, that lend themselves well to the idea of turning into a spider. You know, even if it means you have to reskin it just a little bit, there's a lot of things that can make you a pretty cool spider. Let's talk about powers.
Yeah. Well, the first one is the Swarming Locust. I mean, that's one of the at-will powers. Kind of, I mean, I like I said, I was bouncing back because I wasn't sure how, if I really wanted to incorporate the swarm, but decided can't pass it up for a Priestess of Loth. So, Swarming Locusts, insects launch from you to vex your enemies. Close Blast 3, 1d8 plus Wisdom modifier damage. Blast creates a zone of Swarming Locusts that lasts until the end of your next turn. While within the zone, enemies grant combat advantage.
And this is the one where you're going to be able to pull off that combat advantage that, you know, we've already built into the character both on both of our sides, you know?
It's until the end of your next turn. So you blast it, next turn you shift into spider mode and head in there.
Right. And then I also thought, at least thematically, this one was honestly just purely for thematics. I liked Thorn Whip. You know,
I also picked Thorn Whip.
The idea of a Drow Priestess with a thorny whip, you know, just seems like a natural.
I agree. And just playing a druid a little bit, I think Thorn Whip is actually my favorite non-beast form power.
Sure.
So, yeah, I really love it. Because you can circle the battlefield and basically pull your target to wherever you want.
Yeah.
I mean, as long as it's within two squares of where they are currently. But, I mean, you just kind of move around. And while being able to wild shape, when you shift out of wild shape, you get to shift a square. So druids are really mobile, and you can really just circle the battlefield and pull them wherever you want them to be.
Right, which adds a little bit of extra controlleriness to you.
Yeah.
Any what other powers did you look at that you think are worth mentioning?
Well, I mean, I only picked a couple more powers to kind of fill out my first level build. There's the Savage Rend. You get to slide the target one square. That's my favorite.
Is that your encounter?
Beast form. That's the third at will.
Okay.
For being a druid. Yeah, so beast form.
That's the one where I went with Pounce.
Go ahead.
I was trying to figure out, what seems most spider-like, and I was between the Savage Rend and the Pounce to seem more spider-like, and I opted with that direction.
Yeah, this is actually one choice where I did not really consider that. I just think Savage Rend is really good. So
cool. So what'd you pick for your encounter then?
A Thorn Spray. It's a pretty you blast thorns. It's a close blast 5, do damage and give a penalty to defenses, and since I am a primal predator, the penalty to the defenses is 1 plus my dexterity modifier. So that's a good penalty to apply to my target's defenses for a round. And that one is, I thought, especially if, I mean, like I said, I only look through first level stuff for the most part, but it seems very poisonous. So, I mean, it's just regular type damage, but just change the name from Thorn Spray to Poison Spray or something, or Poison Darts, and it makes a ton of sense.
Sure. And that one works well because it synergizes with your build as a primal predator.
Yeah.
And I did the same thing. I synergized with my build, and I went with the scattered form. So I'm running around as a big swarm of spiders, and you attack me, and I just scatter and take less damage while I chew on you some more.
Seems good. Yeah, I like – there are a lot of options here for building a
– It's amazing how much – when I wasn't sure that Druid made sense for a Priestess of Loth, it's amazing how many different ways you can do it and it makes sense.
Yeah, I don't know. I have a love for this kind of character, I guess. Just, sure. As I mentioned, I play a lot of magic. So
yeah.
One of my favorite combinations of colors in that game is black and green. And the Druid of Loth is just very black green.
Indicative of that. Yeah. So what'd you do with your first level daily then?
Fog of Insects. It's a burst 3, 2d10 plus wisdom modifier damage to the guys you hit, misses half, and you get a bonus to your defenses until the end of the encounter.
Right.
So you're just surrounded now by a fog of insects.
Mm-hmm.
This is one that wasn't my initial conception of just a druid who turns into a big spider, but the swarm build really adds a lot of options to flesh out the theme in a way that I hadn't initially expected. So,
right. And
I thought this was a really cool power.
I went with the same power. I looked at the others, and none of the others seemed bad. It's just none of them seem to fit as much thematically. I could see maybe a wind prison working, but you know, the form of an ape, a bear, a boar doesn't make sense for what I'm doing, right? And summoning
right.
A boar, a toad, or a wolf, this character doesn't really feel like a summoner to me. So Fog of Insects, when I'm already a swarm of spiders, sort of it fit.
Yeah, definitely. And I did look at those form of primal powers, mm-hmm. and I kind of closely read them and said, you know, is this one? Could this one be a spider? Could this one be a spider? And the ape could be because it's got kind of the jumping powers. Uh-huh. I thought, okay, you know, I'm jumping, and the power, I think you push your target, which was not necessarily a spider, but, you know, maybe you could get away with it. And the bear, when you grab, and I was like, well, sometimes spiders grab, you know, so I wouldn't blame anyone who picked one of those who wanted to turn into kind of a more, a primal spider, basically, right. and more thoroughly exemplify that.
Yeah, although I discovered as I continued to build up to higher levels that when you get to fifth level, there is a druid daily power called Form of the Primeval Spider.
Okay, well, then never mind.
which is,
let's,
you know,
take a look at that one.
So that's something I went with later. In fact, this is one of those areas where you have two things very similar that you sort of got to look at closely, right? You have a Dragon Magazine power called Form of the Primeval Spider, where you take the form of a spider and get to do attacks as that spider. And then you also have the power just called Primal Spider, also from a Dragon Magazine, where you also become a Primal Spider, but you have a different set of powers.
Weird. Is that – yeah, I'm looking at Form of the Primeval Spider now.
Uh-huh.
And you get to climb, and then you get to do some immobilization.
Uh-huh.
What's the name of the other one?
The other one is just called Primal Spider. And let's see, it's a standard.
Okay, area burst within 5. Area burst 1.
Uh-huh. You do some poison.
More immobilization, but
do some poison damage. Do some immobilization, which they describe as shooting webs.
Okay, so yeah, here you're shooting webs. Okay.
And it allows you to keep slowing things. So, you know, it's very, very, very similar sort of concepts with slightly different names, both at the same level. Just seemed a little odd to me. What would have been awesome,
is
if they had been different level powers. Then you could take two different spider powers as you progress.
Well, you can still do it as long as the ninth level ones aren't too exciting. But there always are.
Yeah. In fact, my ninth level was Flurry of Stingers.
Oh, wow.
Which
sounds like that's from Primal Power.
Which is from Primal Power. It's another poison one. You know, so a lot of mine ended up being very insect-based or very poison-based.
Which is very encouraging for the Drow Priestess of Loth adventurer to be.
Well, which is also something that you, I think, need to keep in mind when you're building a character is that that's great until the DM throws in one monster with poison resistance, you know, and then suddenly...
No, don't worry. You've got that feat.
Or until the DM throws in something immune to poison. And then, you know, you got to figure out, okay, what's my backup? So it's always good to have a few powers in there as a backup that don't fit the mold of the rest of your character.
That's true. And you can just do that with your just untyped primal powers, or just, you know, go back and use your thorn whip or whatever.
Absolutely. Okay, what have we missed? Have we talked about everything we need to talk about with our drow druidesses?
Let's see. Race, background, ability scores. We didn't really cover our ability scores. I mean, I guess we pretty much went over it. You know, I've got a high wisdom here with good dexterity and charisma, and you've got... I try to go for a high wisdom and constitution.
I put a lot of points into wisdom and constitution, and then that allowed me to just drop my charisma and dex lower without necessarily having really low stats in those areas because of the bonuses.
Yeah. Okay. I guess the last thing I would say then is since I didn't look much farther than level 1, I didn't really look at what warlock powers I would delve into.
Sure.
But that's somewhere I would go here with my character.
Yeah.
so.
And I think there's some really interesting choices to make when you're looking at Paragon paths when you get up to that level. Especially, I really like the Swarm Paragon paths. There's one I like a lot that sort of assumes that whatever you turn into flies, which, you know, I suppose we can be flexible in theme there, because I really like the Whirling Samara Paragon path. The one that says, you know, you cannot be pulled, pushed, or slid. You know, anytime you change your form, you gain a fly speed. You know, it's
okay.
Things like that end up being a lot of fun. You're just whirling around and zooming around the battlefield.
As a swarm, yeah. That's pretty cool. Well, I mean, in a fantasy world, I don't have much of a problem imagining a spider with big dragonfly wings.
Yeah.
If you want to be flying around.
And I think you can sort of, since it's a swarm, you can imagine that there's just a bunch of members of that swarm constantly jumping around and doing things anyway, or swinging on webbing or what have you, you know. I think you can sort of make it work.
Yeah, all right.
Well,
I agree.
I'm going to convert my my two character builds into a PDF, and you're going to send me yours. And when this posts, I will include links in the show notes where people can download the PDFs of what we built, the two different takes of a Drow Druidess.
I'll try to finalize some things on here, like maybe her name, and then send it over.
Good. All right. Now, before we talk about how to pick monsters for your encounters, let's get a bit of advice from Mike Shea over at SlyFlourish.com.
Hello, this is Mike Shea with SlyFlourish.com, where we're helping build a better 4th edition Dungeon Master. Today I'm going to take a look at Divine Power, a book that's primarily focused for players, and look at ways a Dungeon Master can actually use this book at their game table tonight to make for a better role-playing game for everybody involved. Probably the biggest area, the biggest section of Divine Power that everybody's interested in are the actual class powers that you can find in here. The book is mostly class powers. There's hundreds and hundreds of them in here. And unfortunately, there are a few players who will actually use all of the powers in this book. Every player usually only has one character that will actually make it all the way through all of these various levels in order to actually use all of these powers. So they're not likely to use the powers from another class. As a Dungeon Master, however, we could use these. There's no reason we couldn't use these powers as much as we wanted to for just about everything. If you wanted to use them the way the rules state, then you could add as a template to an elite character one of the class templates found on page 188 of the Dungeon Master's Guide for either Cleric or Paladin, and look up the Cleric and Paladin powers from the section in Divine Power and give them those powers. An example that I found that I really like, if I can get to the page, is Pyre of Judgment on page 89. This is one where a enemy, in this case an NPC paladin, would hit strength versus AC for 2 weapon plus strength modifier damage and ongoing 10 fire save ends. When the target takes this ongoing damage, each enemy adjacent to it takes fire damage equal to 5 plus the wisdom modifier of the creature. So here you could take an orc, a regular orc, maybe an orc paladin of Grumash, and give him this power, and suddenly you have a much more powerful orc who is pulling off powers that the players have never seen before. So there's hundreds of these kinds of powers that you could use, and while all of them, they wouldn't all be perfectly balanced to for an NPC or a monster to use, a lot of them would be, and a lot of them wouldn't unbalance the game too much. A second way to use this book is the Divine Backgrounds on page 128 and 129. I'm a huge fan of backgrounds in general. I think they're a great way to bring some storytelling back into a game that's primarily statistical based. And Divine Backgrounds in general offer a way to increase some skills, but also to help give players a shove in the direction of thinking about where their character came from and what their character wants. As a Dungeon Master, this is a great resource, a great thing to keep on hand in order to help flesh out NPCs, particularly if it's an NPC that you didn't really have fleshed out until the players looked at him. So, you know, they might walk into a church and they might start talking to the priest, but there might be an acolyte in the corner that they're actually more interested in talking to, and you never really filled him out. So you pull out your baby book and pull out a random name, and then you look on 128 and you say, well, he followed a cult. He participated in a cult and worshipped a false god before he saw the true path. You know, and then he started following the true path. So there's a lot of ways to use a book like this and to use backgrounds as a quick way for you to flesh out an NPC. I'm a particular fan of doing this with movie archetypes, too. There's no reason you can't grab a character in a movie you really liked and use their character type and their background as a way to fill out an NPC. But having these divine backgrounds and having backgrounds in a lot of these books and using them as quick backgrounds for an NPC can really be very effective. The third way I like using this book at a table is in looking at the Epic Destinies. Like the backgrounds, Epic Destinies are a really great way to fill out the story behind a character. And the Epic Destiny is kind of telling the story of a character as they've gone beyond mortality and turned into something else. But it can also really serve as a good story arc for an adventure or even a campaign. You might have one particular player who you've decided or the player has decided is going to be chosen by a deity. It might even be interesting if the player wasn't planning on their character being chosen, but the deity, in fact, said, nope, you are, in fact, chosen. And now you can have maybe even a 3, a 5, or a 10-level story arc based on exactly how they become chosen and once they become chosen, what they do. Chosen might also be a really interesting epic destiny for a creature to have if they are, in fact, the chosen vessel of Tiamat or the chosen of Loth that are hunting down the players relentlessly. So there's a lot of interesting things that you can do with these. I think that epic destinies are a great way to look at a campaign and look at how that campaign can tailor itself around the players that are playing. So those are 3 quick ways to use this book. Not every book, even though a book might look on the surface like it's built just for players, and in fact can be built for dungeon masters as well. If you're interested in more DM tips like this, please go to slyflourish.com. If you want a daily DM tip, please go to twitter.com/slyflourish. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you, Mike. I look forward to seeing where you go with your advice in future episodes. But now, Andrew, it is time for us to wrangle together our own army of monsters. In my opinion, this is one of the hardest or time-consuming tasks that a DM has to do when they're setting up an encounter. Oftentimes, it comes down to sorting through a massive catalog of monsters that are available to the game and figuring out what your PCs are going to be fighting in the upcoming encounter. I sort of feel like there's 2 basic strategies you can take. There's the mechanics-first strategy, and there's the story-first strategy, and I think they both have advantages and disadvantages. Let's start off by talking about the mechanics first strategy, where you look at the mechanics of the monsters first, right? You say, okay, my party is this level and there's this many of them. That means they should be fighting creatures of you know, in this range of levels. Let me look at all the monsters in that range of levels and then pick out the ones that would work.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like I never really thought about them in those 2 categories before, but I feel like I do both, actually.
Sure.
Because I always want to offer a challenging, level-appropriate encounter, and I always want to be telling a story that involves monsters that that makes sense.
Makes sense, yeah. Well, so, and I feel like when you go – and I did this a lot early on when 4th edition came out. I did a lot of – open up the monster manual. They've got those great indexes in the back that gives you everything – all the monsters listed by – their level, right? And then I can pick out the ones that make the most sense for my encounter, for my story. And then if I need to reskin a few things here and there to make it fit in well, I can do that. It's not horribly difficult to do. And now with the D&D Insider Compendium, if you're a subscriber, it's really simple to sort of do a quick search and set up your filters to give you all the monsters in all the books that fit into that range. So it is fairly quick.
Books and RPGA adventures, which really just floods the thing.
Yeah.
They make so many adventures that there are so many monsters in here.
Yeah. Now, there are times that every now and then I think you have to do a little bit of work, right, to reskin. You know, I might see a monster that's really, really cool and I want to include and it's the right level. And if I don't use them now, they're going to go up a level or two and I won't have another chance to do it. So I want to get them in now. So maybe I have to make that ice worm look a little bit different when they're in the lava caves.
Right.
So I think there's
a lot of changing ice to fire.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a lot of sort of creative work that you need to do in order to make this system work well, I think.
Maybe. I mean, yeah, that's true. I guess I just maybe don't mind doing it. And reskinning isn't really that hard. I mean, you throw in a bunch of kobolds and then you just say they're, you know, the snake people who are in your campaign world or whatever, and you're good to go.
Yeah. And if you're creative enough that you can come up with those things on pretty quickly, it's not a bad system to use. Now, the second strategy is one that I've been using more lately. And that's the give number one importance to making your monsters fit into the story. And then consider the mechanics, which might require some redesigning.
Yeah, yeah. When Fourth Edition came out, I was in the middle of a 3.5 campaign, which I switched to Fourth Edition, and I had plans that there are these vampires, but the players are only like 5th or 6th level, and vampires in the monster manual are starting at like 10th level. Vampire template is requires a Paragon tier monster, basically.
Right.
And that's when I said, okay, well, I'm going to make a bunch of vampires then. And I made a bunch of my own vampires. And that's actually what I posted on the Vorpal Network forums. Uh-huh. So.
Yeah, and I found early on in 4th edition, there were a few times here and there where the choices weren't vast, you know. I had a vision in my head of a certain kind of monster, and there was nothing really out there like that. And so every now and then, I would take the time to build my own monsters. And it's not horribly difficult to do. I found it to be a little bit time-consuming. But then they came out with the Monster Builder. And again, as a D&D, Insider subscriber, I find the Monster Builder completely changes the game for me.
Really?
Yeah,
I've heard good things.
Have you jumped?
I've pulled it up and poked around.
Yeah, but you haven't used it very much.
But no, honestly, I'm actually kind of picky about the output.
Sure.
When you go put it out, it looks pretty good, but part of doing my publishing as a one man kind of deal, one of the first things I did was try to pin down the layout from the original, from the core Wizards books.
Mm-hmm.
And now it's pretty easy for me to go into my software and create a monster that looks just like out of the monster manual once I spent, you know, a couple weeks putting all that together. And so I like mine to look perfect.
Sure.
So when I go into the Monster Builder and it looks really good, I'm still a little disappointed.
Sure. Yeah, I find that the Monster Builder is a game changer for me in terms of DMing, because I am now I pay very little attention to the levels of the monsters when I choose them now. I go into the Monster Builder.
Because you can just press down, down,
right,
down.
I can just say, okay, change it from this level to that level. Hey, look, now that 8th level ice worm is suddenly a 15th level ice worm, and I can use it perfectly for what I want to do.
That does sound pretty handy.
Yeah, it works pretty well. Now, I think there are still some things to consider, especially when you're when you're moving tiers. You know, when you take an epic level monster and convert it to a paragon tier creature, then it's not just a matter of numbers. It's not just a matter of
right.
Go ahead.
The higher level, I'm sure this is what you're basically getting to, but yeah, the higher level monsters have, you know, more intense conditions and more maybe just more ongoing damage that doesn't necessarily, I don't know how well it scales through the Monster Builder, and maybe a saving throw penalty that wouldn't exist if it were a heroic tier monster, and just extra powers that are just kind of too much for lower level characters,
yeah,
stuff like that.
And that's absolutely right. Absolutely right. That's where the Monster Builder is great for crunching the numbers for you, fitting everything into the formulas and making sure everything is balanced in terms of all that. And you can focus as a DM or as a designer on the more artistic side of building a monster, right? Where it's okay.
Right.
I understand that the numbers are fine here now, but this power is going to really mess up a bunch of Paragon tier characters. So it needs to be changed,
yeah,
or adjusted or whatever.
And actually a really great example of kind of that exact phenomenon is just look through a particular color of dragon. Like, mm-hmm, there's like the level 5 solo red dragon, and then there's like the level 10 solo red dragon or whatever. And the numbers scale, but as you get to the higher level ones, they have more and more powers. They have the same breath weapon, the same like double claw, but now the higher one's also going to have like the fear and the extra claw and the extra this. And it's the same powers with the numbers scaled up, but the higher level you get, the more and more powers they get that just shouldn't be there on the lower level version.
Right, exactly.
And
right.
if you consider that higher level monster that doesn't have a hatchling version at level 5, you have to realize that when you modify it to be level 5, consider that dragon phenomenon, that it shouldn't have some of those powers that it has.
Exactly right, yeah. And that comes with the experience of being a DM, but and this is sort of the experience of what I mean by Monster Builder became a game changer for me, is that I used to use strategy one a lot. You know, start with my levels and the mechanics, and then figure out what's going to make the most sense. And, you know, maybe make some tweaks or adjustments here or there. Make a couple of custom monsters, you know, once every two or three sessions. But for the most part, I'm pulling things straight out as they're supposed to be mechanically and just reskinning them as needed. When Monster Builder comes out, though, especially in the last several months, as I've gotten better and better at using it, I'm focused on what's going to work for my game, and I'm rebuilding the mechanics pretty quickly and easily, and in a way that formats pretty close to what I'm used to, you know?
Yeah, I mean, it does look good. It does look good.
Yeah, and honestly, I find that it looks better when you export it. I think it loses some of the aesthetic appeal. It doesn't look as good when you export it as an image as it does when it's in the actual Monster Builder.
Can you print it straight from the Monster Builder and have it look good still?
I haven't tried. But what my trick is that I just do a screen grab.
Yeah, that's a good idea.
I just do a screen grab, and then I can copy and paste it right into my session notes and print them all off together. So my monster build is right there in the middle of my session notes, exactly where it needs to be. So it works pretty well for me.
Yeah, that actually, I might take a look again and with that screen grab technology.
Yeah,
sounds like it'd make the process a little nicer to look at. So
yeah, it works well for me anyway. Now I think you mentioned that you actually have some shortcuts to consider if you need to adjust the level of a monster to make it fit into your encounter.
Well, I mean, I wouldn't call it a shortcut. I think the Monster Builder is the shortcut. It's a really fast, easy way to do something. I actually kind of like building monsters and spending a little more time on them. Mm-hmm. So this is a system kind of that I've concepted and used in my campaigns, is that a higher level monster, I mean, some people will take that level 10 monster and just say, well, I want a level 4 version, and it's no problem. And that's fine. Some other people, and I think this is kind of floats from older editions maybe, but they say, well, this monster is a level 15 monster. Like, there are no level 4 versions of this in the world, you know? Like, I don't know, let me try to think of something real quick. I don't know, what's a good high level monster?
A Remoraz.
All right, let's see if I can spell that. I cannot. Remoraz is level 21 brute, and it is an elite. Let's see, in the legendary Remoraz from Dragon Magazine issue 377 is a level 15 solo, which is actually pretty much perfect for what I'm about to go over. So say you've got a Remoraz, you're running a campaign, and you want your players to fight a Remoraz, but they're only level 15. And you say, well, the Remoraz is a level 21 monster. I could go into the monster builder and make it level 15, and that's easy. But some DMs are going to say, well, wait a minute. Remorazes are stronger than that. There are no level 15 Remoraz. That's not, you know, how strong a Remoraz is. Mm-hmm. And they, you know, that's just a kind of a thing. And I kind of like that. I don't know, kind of ambiguous. But if you're that kind of DM who doesn't want to just make a level 15 version, a trick that I like to do is say, well, imagine what it would be like for a group of level 15 characters to fight a level 21 Remoraz. It's not going to be, mechanically, it's a bad idea. Right. Like, you just shouldn't, I mean, five or six levels isn't that far off, but there's a limit, and that's really getting to the point of that limit where the AC and the numbers are just too disparate to create a fun encounter. And what I like to do there is say, well, you can represent a level 21 elite monster by building a level 16 solo monster. And my search on the compendium actually revealed that's pretty much exactly what they did. They made a Dragon Magazine article where they wanted a level of a Remoraz around level 15, and they created a level 15 solo monster. Yep. And if you were saying, well, I'm going to have my level 26 characters fight a Remoraz, they are way too powerful, right, for this level 21 monster. So I'm going to create a level – I'm going to represent that same monster at a higher level by building a level 26 standard monster. So you take away the elite portion. Obviously, this isn't something you can do as easily in the monster builder. Does it let you just like remove and add the elite status to monsters?
Yes.
Okay, so you can do that.
I actually at one point took an elite creature, turned it into a solo lower, you know, paragon tier creature, just like you're talking about, and then decided it needed some babies around it too, and so I converted that creature into a minion.
Yeah, that's perfect.
So yeah,
yeah. Does it? How much of the work does it do for you? Because like, Dungeon Master's Guide 2 pretty much goes over how to make that switch. Right. You know, you don't want to just change the hit points or the defenses and the saving throw bonus. You need the powers really need to change with it.
Right. It changes all those numbers that you're talking about. It also changes the numbers in the power. So it changes the damage and the to hit bonuses in the powers. But you still have to pay very careful attention to what those powers do besides damage. That can be the real tricky part of the whole thing is, you know, it doesn't make sense for a swarm of minions to be doing, you know, daze effects every time they hit, you know, or whatever.
Right. Yeah. Have the recharge when bloodied breath weapon.
Right. Yeah. 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 that kind of thing.
Yeah. And as someone who hasn't really used the monster builder and who likes building monsters by hand, I basically start with the idea of the monster and then go from scratch. Mm-hmm. Like I'll read the monster and see what kind of abilities it has, but pretty much I'm just creating a whole new monster from the concept at this new level. So yeah, you want your party of level 26 characters to fight a Remoraz, make it a level 26 standard monster, and make a group of them, you know, or put one and then like a group of frost giants, or I don't know what level frost giants are or whatever. But so that's kind of the thing. And in my campaign, a really iconic way that I think you could use this method is something I've started to do. I created a sorcerer and I built him as a level 5 solo character. Mm-hmm. You know, he's level 5 solo, and then he escaped at the end. You know, they had him down to a few hit points and he escaped. And when they encounter him again, he'll be around a level 10 elite. Mm-hmm. You know, he's not as powerful anymore compared to them. And now he's represented as being a higher level so that he can actually compete with them on a mathematical scale in game mechanic terms. But he's only an elite now.
Right.
And if they encounter him again after that, he's going to be a level 15 standard monster.
Sure. So it's a way of bringing him back without, you know, having to level up your enemies, but still having them make sense mechanically in a fight with the party.
Exactly.
Yeah. So
and then when they're level 20 and they find out who he's been working for and they encounter him in a battle with his boss, he's a level 20 minion now. You know, and I think if they finally take him out at that point, that could be really satisfying. Say, we've had all these fights with you. You're a solo, you're elite, you're a standard monster. Now you're just a minion to us because we are stronger now.
Yeah, that's really, really smart. And not something – I mean, something you can absolutely do in the monster builder, but not something that is necessarily intuitive in the monster builder to set it up that way. And so I think that's really interesting to think about. Cool. All right. Well, we've talked the heck out of that. Let's summarize real quick. I think we discovered today that druids make surprisingly good priestesses of Loth due to some of the thematic elements that the class makes available.
Absolutely. Yep.
Not only are there lots of spider abilities, but there's lots of cool things with thorns and whips that work well for our evil priestess of Loth.
That's right. And if you want to go into the Player's Handbook 3, you can grab some Seeker powers and use your Drow crossbow.
Ooh, yeah, even better. So, and then we also talked about fitting monsters into the game, either doing it mechanically first, as long as you're willing to do some creative work with your storytelling, or starting with your story first and then doing some mechanical work to make that make sense against whatever level your party is, although the monster builder does make that quick. And Andrew provided some good tips on how to step up the power level mechanically without actually making a creature seem like they're getting more powerful just because the party is. So does that cover what we talked about?
Yeah, I think so.
All right. Then that is episode 130. People can email me at thetomeshow@gmail.com, or don't forget to visit the brand spanking new forums at vorpalnetwork.com. You'll be able to find me there, and I believe Andrew's going to hang out there for a bit as well.
Yep, I think I'm a fission essence on there.
Yes, you are, as you are in many places.
Yep, that's true. I'm on Twitter as silent, then the number 7, then the word 7. That's uh-huh. also the website, mm-hmm. silent77.com. So you can find me there or email me at andrew.w@silent77.com.
Cool. Any other places people actually can go to check you out?
Twitter? I think that's a pretty good list.
Twitter and the website pretty much cover you.
Right. Yeah.
Good. Then I want to thank you for being on the show, as well as thanking our sponsors, NobleKnight.com. Other than that, I want to encourage everybody to get out there and let people know about the show. Do it with a review on iTunes or on another site, or get out there and tell people personally about it. Word of mouth is the biggest way that the show can spread, I think. And the more we spread, the more things we can do. And don't forget to consider checking out the Tome's Amazon store for products discussed on the show and more, or at least the physical products. The show gets a part of the proceeds, and that helps keep us on the air. And of course, you can check out RPG Now or DriveThruRPG to check out Silent 7 products.
Silent 7. Yeah. Yeah, the 7 in the middle is silent. That's part of the deal there.
Yeah. Was that intentional? The Silent 7 has a Silent 7 in it?
Right, yeah.
Good.
It's kind of an inside joke from a while back. But yeah, that's the deal. That's the deal there. You can just say Silent 7. Just know that there's a Silent 7 there in the middle.
Sure. And if anybody doesn't want to bother trying to figure out how to spell Silent 7, they can always find links for that and other things mentioned in the show notes at the website at thetomeshow.com. All right. We've survived the lashes of a drow priestess, waded through an army of monsters, and successfully found ourselves at the end of episode 130, building a drow druid and picking monsters for your encounters of
The Tome. I'm on the wall.